the organisers of the Gang Tour and a very enjoyable conference. Great fun. So, first of all, I'm going to use N equals half supersymmetry as a synonym equivalent terminology for not inclusive supersymmetry. It's easy to say, and also I'll show exactly why I use that in the learning. So, it will occur naturally in superstring background supersymmetry, propagating certain backgrounds, but I'm primarily interested in it as a nice arena where you can study deformations of all the supersymmetry in some nice features here.
I'm going to start by just rehearsing the standard n equals 2, in fact, supersymmetry in two dimensions, just to set the scene and also try to see to what extent the features of the ordinary supersymmetry are reproduced in n equals half supersymmetry. So then I'll go on to discuss the n equals half supersymmetry in two dimensions, and as I say, try to show how it differs from ordinary supersymmetry. And then in particular, I'll be interested in trying to see how we can renormalize the n equals half supersymmetry in two dimensions. And then find some conclusions. So, as we all know, ordinary supersymmetry, n equals 1 supersymmetry, is most easily expressed in superspace, so I introduce the graphs and coordinates of thetas, which have the standard commutation relations. But this supersymmetry can be deformed by making some of the superspace coordinates non-antiquing. And the simplest thing to do is to make the thetas not antiquing, so it's the right-hand side, and obviously the right-hand side here, and the anticommutators of the theta bars are unchanged. And so this leads to a modified supersymmetry algebra. The anticommutators of the Qs are left unchanged, but the anticommutator of the Q bars requires a non-branching right-hand side, which depends on this matrix C. The Y here is a chiral coordinate made by this out of the ordinary coordinates. And so because the algebra of the Qs is unchanged, but the algebra of the Q bars is modified, we can say that half of supersymmetry is left unchanged or unbroken. And so that's the origin of the name n equals half supersymmetry. I should say that gauge theory in this concept is discussed by these people, Seiberg, Arar, Karatau. Quantum corrections and realizability of the four-dimensional theory are being looked at by all these people. And now I'm going to go on to just recapitulate the ordinary standard supersymmetry in two dimensions. So in this concept, it's convenient to use the light-term coordinates, x plus minus and so on. And then these are going to be the chiral superfields, with the usual components, scalar and fermion and jittery fields. And then in the undeformed case, which I'm going to discuss first, then the thetas have these usual commutators, being zero. And these are supersymmetry charges, just paralleling the discussion I just went through four dimensions, and again in terms of this chiral components, these chiral coordinates. And these have the usual algebra. Once again, all the anticommutators are vanishing, except of course for the Q bars and the Qs, which is your derivative right hand side. And then the n equals 2 nonlinear sigma model in two dimensions looks like this in superspace. It's an integral over the A potential, which depends on the chiral and anti-chiral fields. And we can expand the superfields in terms of the component fields, like this, the phi and the phi bar. Once again, the component fields, phi, psi, and f, are going to be functions of these chiral coordinates, the y's. And then if you do the integral over the thetas and theta bars, then you get the component action for the n equals 2 theory, and it looks like this. It has this rather complicated expression. the subscripts here denote the derivative with respect to either the bar field, the anti-parallel fields, or the unbarred pool. In the unbarred subscripts represent derivatives with respect to the parallel fields, the bias. This is rather complicated, but if you eliminate F by its greater notion, then you get this more familiar form for the nonlinear sigma model, where the arbitrary space metric here is just related to the dual derivative of the Kähler potential. So this is the Kähler metric, and R here is a Riemann tensor constructed out of this Kähler metric. So this is a familiar form for the nonlinear sigma model. It's going to be useful for later purposes to represent the charges, the Qs, by differential operators that act on the fields, so like this. So the action of a Q on phi is going to be represented by a differential operator, a little Q, acting on the field. These operators in this undeformed case look like this. I've put a zero here because in the deformed case, in the n equals half case, these operators are going to get modified. These are going to stay the same. And now we can write the full Kähler potential in terms of this string of operators acting on the Kähler potential just as a function of the scalar fields, the little phi and little phi bar. So this string of operators just puts in all the dependence on the size and psi bars and F's and F bars into the full Kähler potential. And then, let's go back a bit. If we want to get the action components, then these two superspace integrals are going to pick out the highest components in theta and theta bars. Okay, so the n equals fraction is going to come from this times this times this times this, the highest power of theta and theta bars. So it's just going to have this expression in terms of these operators. So that's quite a simple compact expression for the component action here. And then because these operators, the Qs and the Q bars are nilpotent, they all square to zero, then it's manifest that the Q and Q bar acting on the action is zero, which just expresses the force of supersymmetry of the action. So then all this kind of labouring the point a lot, but the point I want to try to extend this to the deformed case in a moment. So my interest is going to be to try to do the one corrections for this theory in the deformed case. So what happens in the undeformed case, the standard case is well known. In dimensional regularization, we can account for the one loop divergences by replacing the classical Kähler potential by a bare version. But one loop, it looks just like this. We just have to add a term proportional to the trace the log of the Kähler metric onto the classical Kähler potential. And this corresponds to a simple modification of the Kähler metric. You're just adding onto the Kähler metric a term proportional to the Richter tensor for the constructs out of the Kähler metric. So the point is that in the standard undeformed case, you've got this nice geometrical picture of what's going on in terms of sigma model constructs out the Kähler metric, and then the model corrections being interpreted in terms of adding terms proportional to the Ricci tensor onto the Kähler metric. And so what I want to do later is try to see to what extent we can reproduce this in the deformed case. Now the answer is going to be hardly at all, unfortunately. But it's going to be useful later to try to visualize what's going on here diagrammatically. When you start acting on this potential with these operators, the effects of a q-bar, for instance, is to generate an inverse of the k, which is represented by the k with the upper indices of the subscripts. Okay, and I'm going to represent this inverse k metric by a propagator, and then this derivative of k is represented by the vertex, and then the external field is represented by this arrow coming off the diagonal. And then when you act with a further q bar, that can have the effect of adding additional vertices or modifying the vertex you have. Or if the operator acts on this propagation, in other words on the inverse, then it can generate new propagators just because of the fact that the derivative of the inverse k is just k to the minus 1 times the derivative of k times k to the minus 1. And so when you differentiate a single propagator, you generate two propagators with a vertex between them. So that's what's happened here. The derivative action on the propagator has generated two propagators and a vertex. Should be minus sign here, actually. Okay, so as I say, I'll see to what extent all this goes through in the deform n equals half case. So first of all, in the deform case, we make a simple modification to the anticommutators. We just modify the anticommutator of theta plus and theta minus, leave all the others unchanged. And then the n equals half algebra is then identical to the undeformed case, except that the anticommutator two q bars requires a non-zero right-hand side involving this parameter here. And then we can implement this non-anticommutativity at the level of the superfields by introducing a star product, what's called the Moyard star product, which behaves like this, theta plus star theta minus applies this condition term of the plus sign, theta minus star theta plus the other way around. Also apply it becomes minus theta plus theta minus, and again plus 1 over 2m. And then this combination of these two results implements this non-zero, non-vanishing anticommutator. And so it's then quite simple to deform the theory to get the n equals half version of the theory just by replacing all products by these star products. And so in particular, if we've got the undeformed here potential expressed in the power series in terms of phis and phi bars, then we just have to replace these ordinary products by star products. And in fact, the precise what we should do is to replace this product by a symmetrized star product of all possible orderings of n phis and n phi bars. So we can recover in the symmetrized product. And you can show then that the deformed Hilbert potential again has a reasonably straightforward expression in terms of operators acting on now these things k0 and k1, which are defined by this integral here. So once again, this string of operators here creates all the dependence on the psi and the psi bars and the f bars out of these simpler expressions just involving the scalar and the auxiliary field. A slight complication here is that these operators with a double prime subscript just represent the parts of the operator acting on either the unbarred, the chiral fields, or the barred, the anti-chiral fields. So the double prime here represents an operator acting on the bar fields. And the prime operators here represent an operator acting just on the chiral fields, the unbarred fields. So the deformed action is going to look like this. We just place the ordinary Hilbert potential by the star version. And once again, that's just going to come from the highest order Simon Peter say we need this and this and this and this. And so it looks just looks like this. And we can separate that into two parts, one coming from here and one coming from here. And in all its kind of gory detail of the first coming from the K0 looks like this. It's a mess. And the sound coming from the K1 looks like this, and it's a slightly smaller mess. But what I want to do is to, I just want to go back a bit. I want to try to see to what extent we can write the action like this in terms of operators that, in terms of these operators that are going to represent the supersymmetry. And so, so if we try to construct the operators that implement the new deformed algebra, so they have to give this non-zero anticommutator between the Q bars. Turns out they look like this. So again, rather a mess. They start out with the original operators. That should be a Q plus actually here and a Q minus here. But then you have to add all the additional terms involving the deformation parameter. And these operators O tilde and O appearing here and here and here, just defined by their action on the K naught and K1 like this. You can give explicit expressions to these, but they're rather complicated, so I'll suppress those. And so it turns out that now in terms of these operators that represent the full deformed algebra, we can write the action like this in terms of these full deformed operators. As it first appears, you get K0 and K1 here, but in fact, because again, Q plus Q minus are nilpotents, you can forget about these terms here, and they're annihilated by Q plus and Q minus. And then once again, because of the nilpotency of the Q plus bars and so on, it's manifest that Q plus and Q minus will annihilate the action, and that demonstrates the that demonstrates the invariance of this action in the deformed translations. So just to sum up where we are now, in the undeformed case, the standard case, we wrote the classical action in terms of these operators, the undeformed operators, and then we saw that the one-loop corrections could be written in a similar form, just replacing the Kähler potential by a bare version. We've now seen how in the n equals half case we can again write the tree level classical action in terms of these deformed operators acting on K0 now. And so we want to see in the one level can we find a way of representing the one bare action as Q plus Q minus bar acting on something, just as we did in the tree level in the classical case, in the undeformed case. Unfortunately, the answer turns out to be no, we can't. When we do the calculation of one loop, we can show that certainly Q plus and Q minus annihilates the one loop pair action, so that's consistent only with Q plus and Q minus here. But you can also easily see that in fact Q plus bar and Q minus bar don't annihilate the one loop action. The one loop pair action, and so that's inconsistent having a Q plus bar and Q minus bar here. It's going to be because Q plus and Q minus are nilpotent, so if this was true, then this would have to be true, and it isn't. And so it turns out the best thing you can do is just write the bare action in terms of just Q plus and Q minus act on something. Just abandon the idea of pulling out a Q plus bar and a Q minus bar. In fact, the expansion of K0 and K1 starts, in this case, 1 over m squared, in this case at 1 over m, but there's a 1 over m in here already, and so in fact the whole expansion starts at order 1 over m squared. And so what we've done is to calculate everything to one loop and also the first order in 1 over m squared, and then it turns out that this object here has this expression here, ln, this m squared, these m squared terms here, the one over m squared terms in the classical action, and these things here are most conveniently written diagrammatically, as I showed how to do a few transparencies ago. This picture here just shows the diagrams that go into A3, but it's similar expression for A1, A2, and A4. So at the end of the day, we get a fairly succinct expression for the one loop terms, but unfortunately, that's not quite as succinct as we were hoping. So just to conclude, really, we first of all showed how to express n equals half supersymmetry quite compactly in terms of these differential operators that implement the charges. We've also got a fairly compact expression in terms of a kernel. That's my sort of terminology for this kernel K here. So if we can express the one-loop expressions fairly compactly in terms of a kernel, although not as fully concise as we were hoping. Unfortunately, there's no obvious geometric interpretation of these results in terms of a metric or a deformed metric or a modified one loop metric, as was the case in the undeformed case. There's really no obvious geometric interpretation of these results. And just finally, we could probably do the same thing. You introduce a similar operator form in four dimensions, and now we're trying to do that at the moment. And that's it. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Yes.
So, what is the present status in extending this to four dimensions? Are you just working on this, or?
We're working at the moment. It's almost trivial, really, to be honest. Certainly to extend it to the four dimensional Western Union model is quite trivial. The algebra is the same, essentially. So the less trivial part will be to extend it to a four dimensional gauge theory as well. That's more difficult than we haven't just started doing that yet.
And what would be kind of a smoking gun signal of an n equal 1/2 extension of the standard, say, for instance? How would you?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think I'm not sure how realistic these theories are, really, because they're not permissions. So because of theta and theta bars behave differently, they're not permission theories. So I think it's quite hard to interpret them. Realistically, I think if they had any realistic interpretation at all, it would have to involve some kind of decaying particle interpretation. As I said at the beginning, I'm really interested in these things as sort of technical laboratories rather than realistic field theories, I guess.
Okay, so if there are no other questions, we can thank the speaker again.